Hello and welcome to part five of architecture for the SA exam. Caroline and I are back again with Ted and Anya. And if you have not listened to part one through four, we covered an overview of the exam. We covered building secure architectures, resilient architectures, and building for performance. So today we're going to have a treat and we're going to build for cost-optimized architectures, which is my favorite because I like saving money. Thank you, everyone, for coming back.
Thanks for having us back, Dave and Caroline. It's great to be here.
It's great to be back, Dave. Thank you.
Always, always. So let's start off with what percentage of the exam is cost optimization, and then start out defining some of the terms for people.
Sure. So 20% of the scored content is related to cost-optimized architectures. So in the cloud, we pay for what we use as we use it. So we're going to talk about some of the various AWS cost management service features. So I think we can talk about things like cost allocation tags, and we can spend some time talking about multi-account billing and how both of these really can help us with identifying our costs and separating them as well. And then we can get into some of the cost management tools that are just part of the AWS experience. We can talk about Cost Explorer, AWS budgets, and cost and usage reporting.
And the other thing I think we'll mention also, Ted, is some services that you may not think about that might accumulate kind of hidden costs, such as data transfer. So we definitely want to touch upon that as well. As customers may not think about that initially as something as running in their environment and accumulating costs, and then they might be unexpectedly hit with a high bill. So we want to cover some of those pitfalls as well, so they're aware of that.
Yeah, there are a lot of different metrics that are used in billing in AWS. And, you know, when we start talking about designing cost-optimized solutions, I think one thing that we really want to think about that I don't really have indicated in my outline anywhere specific is your costs are going to change based on the region that you're working in.
Huh.
And it costs, for example, it costs a lot more to run an EC2 instance in Sao Paulo, Brazil, than it does in Oregon.
Why is that?
Well, the cost is different to AWS. Taxing is different. Utilities cost different. Internet access costs different rates. So we have, you know, over 30 regions around the world, and the cost is different. So if you can get a cost savings by moving to a more cost-effective region, as a customer, that's your choice. Now, that may not be... Oh, go ahead, Anya. Oh.
To know, Ted, that's a great point that you're bringing up as far as choosing a region based on costs if you don't have other constraints like compliance and data residency. But how would we know what is the most cost-effective region for a workload? How do you go about making that choice?
Yeah, that's a good question. You should run a quote. It would be nice if there was a tool that we had in AWS that could run a quote for us, and there is. If you go to, and I'll leave this in the show notes, calculator.aws is the URL, and that's the AWS pricing calculator. And this is a great place to start when we're looking at pricing any service like EC2 and bringing in these different metrics like, is this a reserved instance? Am I using a savings plan? Is this a spot instance? All of these things we haven't talked about yet that are things that we can use to save money on the cost of running compute in this example.
And Ted,
but you can go ahead.
Keep me honest here, but I think I've heard, Andy Jassy or Adam in many of their keynotes say that every time we can cut costs, we actually go ahead and pass that on to the customer. And I think that comes as the region expands and we, you know, grow it, that actually we start to see the costs come down, right?
Oh, definitely. And I'd like that we try to pass the cost on to the customer as far as if there's a cost savings, let's pass that on to the customer. A really good example I have of this is with EC2 instances. And as we come out with new EC2 instance series, like let's say I had an M4 extra large instance, and now there is an M5 extra large instance available. Generally, that number in M4 to M5 is a generation indicator. And when there's a new generation, we tend to have better price performance.
That is so, such an important point, Ted. Sorry, I'm interrupting you here.
No, but go for it.
I remember when I was first getting started with AWS, I believe we were on M3 instances and they were the newest. And I remember noticing that the new instances seemed to be cheaper. And that was so surprising to me. I couldn't understand why we were encouraged to upgrade and migrate to newer instances. It's like, how is AWS making it cheaper for us? That's so counterintuitive. But that's a great example of the economies of scale that AWS has, right? Because there's just so much compute that we are able to offer to our customers, and we get these great discounts for them that they're able to leverage. And as compute becomes more efficient, that is an opportunity to not just increase your efficiency, but also save money. So that's a really great point.
Yeah, I think it's not always 100% the case. But if there's a new generation instance out, you want to take a look at it and run the numbers for yourself. A lot of times you're going to get, not only are you going to get, you know, better price performance, but what does that mean? That means I might get more processing power, I might get more networking speed, and I might get more memory for the same instance size, if it's an X large or a large. So
yeah, we did an episode on Graviton with a partner too, and they were talking about the cost savings of something like 30% moving from each version of the Graviton processor.
Yeah, and that's another potential cost savings, is moving from an Intel chip to an ARM-based chip. Does that work for every workload? Maybe not, because you might have to recompile your code. But yeah, that could be a, if I'm running Python, does my Python really care if it's on ARM or Intel? Probably not. So, yeah, I think great minds think alike here, Dave, as far as, you know, the cost savings go with EC2 instances. Another thing that, you know, we were just mentioning in the preamble here was we were talking a little bit about tagging. Anya, how do you see tagging as being effective in cost savings?
Tagging is, maybe we should first define what tagging means for our listeners who are not aware of this practice. So tagging is essentially assigning labels to your services. Let's say you have a handful of compute instances running in your environment, and you want to be able to distinguish which ones of them maybe belong to a certain application or workload, or which ones belong to a particular team, or maybe environment, like if you're running things for multiple environments like dev, staging, or production in one account, how do you distinguish what belongs where, right? So tagging gives you this ability to essentially tag it, let's say with a name, name environment like dev, or environment stage, environment prod, or maybe team accounting, team developers. So it gets you to be able to associate different instances with different types of workloads and groups of people. And that allows you to then run different types of cost reports based on these tags to understand how these costs are allocated among the different groups of resources to be able to track where your costs fall. So that's a really great methodology for you to be able to distinguish essentially how much your workloads are consuming. Not only that, you can use tags for other things, but in the context of costs specifically, they're very effective at doing that within one account.
And what different tools for costs actually help us link back to the tags on our different resources that we've implemented?
There's a couple of tools, Caroline, that our customers can use for costs. Probably the very first tool that a customer may encounter in their cost journey with AWS is probably the Cost Explorer tool. It's something that you can search for in your console. Just search for Cost Explorer. And it's a great tool for you to dive into the costs within your account. And you can filter by all kinds of things like region. You can filter by service type. You can filter by tags and things like that. And you can see what kind of cost you're looking at to be able to optimize things and where you can get some savings. So Cost Explorer is probably the first one that you would become familiar with. Then there's other things such as the cost and usage report, which is a much more in-depth version of everything that goes on in your account in terms of billing. And it's essentially a giant CSV file, like a giant Excel that you can export from your account that has line items for every single thing that is accruing costs in your account. And you would be able to really dissect in a very minute way of where costs are going. Typically, I have not seen people using the cost and usage report just out of the box. They typically use it in some kind because it's just so big. It's overwhelmingly big. It's super detailed and incredibly useful, but typically people would use it in some kind of downstream analysis or a business intelligence tool, like a QuickSight or a Tableau or something like that, to where they ingest that data and are able to build visuals on top of it to really dissect and dive deeper into what they want. But it's a super also very effective tool alongside Cost Explorer that we've got. Ted, can you think of others that you might add to those?
Well, the first tool I used, I don't know if it's a tool, but I would say AWS free tier is where to get started, you know, especially if you're studying for this exam and you need to build and get some experience. There are services that are always free, and there are also services that have 12 months free. We'll leave a link in the show notes to aws.amazon.com/free. And now you've got these free services. So you want to run an EC2 instance and an RDS instance free for a year and do your WordPress blog? Great. Then that's how I got my first year of AWS experience, was just running that. DynamoDB, Lambda, you get 3.2 million seconds of compute a month forever for free. There are a lot of free options available in the free tier, but there's a problem with that, or a challenge, let's say. And that challenge is, okay, great. So I've got this stuff running for free and I'm on a budget studying for my solutions architect. I'd like an alert if I'm going past this free tier, or I'm going to spend more than $5 this month in my free tier account, or I'm going to spend more than $500 or $5,000 in this account. And that's where AWS budgets comes in. And you can set budgets for not just your actual spend, but what is your predicted spend based on how much you've spent so far this month and what you have running in your accounts. And you can have notifications let you know that you are exceeding a specific amount.
That was one of the first things I set up, yeah, was those alerts. And I did hit them right away. So highly recommended. And I just have to give a plug to my old team, Amazon Q. It's on the actual product pages as well as in the console. So like, I'll give you an example. I was just in the console while we were talking here, talking to Q about cost optimization, asking about S3. And it's not only explaining all the services, it gives you links. So it gave me a link right out to Macy, because I was like, I'd love it if you could look at my S3 buckets. It's like, I don't have access to the buckets, but here are services that you can enable that can and help you with cost optimization. So once again, me and my AI friends out there, I just love it, you know, being able to talk back and forth. It's a great resource, both in the console and on the product pages that's out there now too. So I would plug Amazon Q.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
It's a great learning tool.
Yeah. And when we look at, you know, cost optimization, storage is a huge place where we can optimize our cost. When we look at S3, we could spend an hour just talking about different tiers of storage in S3, from standard tier to Glacier Instant Access. We can talk about intelligent tiering that would move data from one tier to another. These are all things that you should really know for the Solutions Architect exam, knowing what are the different storage tiers for S3 and why would I choose one over another.
And cost is a big factor in that decision, right? Because typically storage that is more readily available, quicker to retrieve, something like S3 standard, for example, will always be more expensive than something that is archival storage. And that's going to be would be cheaper price. So it just depends on what your solution requires. And that's how you make those choices.
Yeah, and when we think of how we pay for S3, we pay for the amount of storage per month. We pay for data transfer and data transfer out. Not for data transfer in typically, but typically for data transfer out. And then we also pay for verbs, for the gets that we do, for all of these REST representational state transfer types of actions that we do. So these are the different metrics that we use for S3, and they change per storage class. One interesting fact that I've heard from several places is that 80% of our data is not accessed all that often.
I believe it.
So a potential cost savings for our customers is moving that data that is stored in S3 to a different access layer, to something, to an infrequently accessed tier, where maybe it's just as available, but it costs a little bit more to retrieve that data, and you pay less to store that data over time.
And this is when you think about how often you might want to access that data going forward, right? So if an organization wants to archive their data and they might only want to access it, let's say, once a quarter or once a year, then it becomes more cost effective. But if you put something into archival storage but end up accessing it a lot, then it's not a good fit. So you kind of have to think about what is going to be your access pattern going forward. One thing I wanted to double click on though, Ted, is you were mentioning these operations, right? You said something about operations on the files. Let's talk a little bit more about that to our users, because that does come up on the exam. And sometimes I think readers overlook that in the question, because that is sort of a cost you might not think about, right? It's not just the volume of data. So could you talk a little bit more about what these operations are that you mentioned?
Sure. So when we're accessing S3, we're using HTTP. So we do a HTTP GET. And there is a minute charge for each GET, each of these, I think of them as verbs. From, you know, using like Postman and these other tools that I use to access programmatically. So there is a charge for the volume of the, if we're storing our data in a S3 bucket and we're using standard tier, that has a very minimal, that's really where we keep frequently accessed data. Like maybe my website, content that's frequently accessed would be a good place for that. So the charges that we're charged for the gets is minimal compared to if I were doing a get against a Glacier frequently accessed tier. And I think of Glacier as where I send data to die, right? And my reason for that is we're putting that data on ice. I don't expect to ever have to use my backup or archival data, but in case I need it, it's there and it is highly available, durable.
And if there is such a difference between these costs, what different tools can people out there leverage to take advantage of these different tiers?
That's a good question. One of the easiest tools to implement is a system that we call intelligent tiering on S3. And what intelligent tiering will do is, based on your actual access of the objects in S3, it's intelligently moved to the most cost optimal storage medium. And it's great. It is an easy way to turn this on a bucket and instantly save money.
So now, free money.
Yeah. Well, there's a management fee per object, but for most use cases, it's minimal compared to, again, 80% of your data is not commonly accessed. You know, the older your data is, the less you access it. So to have something automate this for you is, yeah, free money.
And it's also great to have intelligent tiering be applied to data that you may not know how it will be accessed, right? Because sometimes you start storing files and you don't know how your organization will be accessing these files. That's where intelligent tiering really becomes powerful, because it sort of does it for you to determine what is the best storage tier, right? There is another way to do it as well once you are more aware of the access patterns. I don't believe we have yet touched upon lifecycle policies. That is something that you can also leverage, but this they come in more once you understand what the access patterns of your data are. So lifecycle policies are more about archiving or moving your data to a different, less expensive storage class after a certain period of time. For example, like if you have data in your standard S3 standard storage class, and if you know that after, let's say, 30 days, you're just not going to be leveraging that data or using it as much, you can set up a policy to automatically move that data into some kind of archival storage to essentially save costs. So they are a little bit different from intelligent tiering, but that's also an option.
One other thing that I think is really important when we talk about our customers and how they're using data, it's not just S3. You know, we also have to optimize block store and EFS as well. Another common scenario is we have hybrid customers where they still have a data center. Everyone doesn't move to AWS in one day. So we have these hybrid customers that have on-prem data centers and they're connected to AWS, and we have storage in two places. So there are also tools that we have like DataSync, our storage gateways and transfer families that we can use to sort of optimize and also cache on the edge these local files.
Do they, in the exam, do they get into, like when we look at the design part of this perspective, do they start asking questions around backups? Because a lot of this is like the types of storage that we're doing around the cost, but do backups fall into that too? And how much it or is that more, backups are kind of like part of these other services we've been talking about?
No, I think backups are and resilience planning and disaster recovery planning is really important. I think two terms that are really important when we talk about backups are RTO and RPO, recovery time objectives, yep, and recovery point objectives. How much data can we afford to lose? And how much time can we afford to be down restoring our data from backup?
So which one, Ted? RTO and RPO, just to clarify that.
The recovery time objective is, you know, now I've got to think now because I've got myself.
Yeah, I thought you were telling me to go back to the office, Ted.
Yeah. So let's see. The recovery time. Now I got to think about this because I want to make sure I get it right. Hold on.
Time.
Right. Yeah. Recovery time objective is how much interruption disrupts the normal operation. So how much revenue is lost over the time of that disaster. So how much downtime can we have with the recovery time objective? Okay, the recovery point objective is basically how often we're doing our backup.
Yep. How much data can you stand to lose, right? So essentially, if you're doing your backups, let's say every day at midnight, right? If something goes down, I don't know, at 6 p.m., right, and you're starting to lose data between 6 p.m. and midnight, and you only took the backup, you know, the night before, you would essentially lose all that data between midnight and, you know, 6 p.m. until you come back up. So that is kind of the recovery point objective. So it's very important to keep that in mind, because if you have very strict recovery point objectives, that is when you set up your backups to be much more frequent.
Yeah, and seamless. Remember in the old days when I used to have backups, and I'd put my backups on tape and I'd put them in a red case, and a courier would come and take them off site for me every day. And that was just part of my routine working on site.
Yeah. I love going in the server room and loading up all the tapes.
Yeah, we actually have, when we talk about a storage gateway, we have a virtual tape library that you can use as a feature. So you can have your on-prem back up to S3, and it just looks like a tape library. So use the technology you have, and now you're backed up to the cloud.
And what about the recovery time objectives? Now I had to think about it. What different approaches can we take to, or methodologies can we follow to make sure we're catering to our business correctly?
Well, I think, you know, it's sort of a function of cost. How much downtime? You can go to no downtime, but that's going to cost you more than a backup and recovery solution, right? Mm-hmm. So we can start with backup and recovery, where we do a timed backup to something like tape or to S3, and it's going to take a lot of time. We're going to have some downtime to recover. Then we can sort of move that scenario to more of a pilot light scenario, where we're doing backups, but maybe I have a redundant database that's being written to from on-prem to being in the cloud at the same time. And I can spin up some EC2 instances on demand to take the load. Okay, that's a little bit more available. I go from maybe hours of recovery time to minutes of recovery time. And it's sort of a sliding scale until we get to the point where we may have a multi-site active recovery with data being replicated in real time, where if we have a failure, whether it's on-site or if a region for some reason was ever unavailable, that we wouldn't lose anything.
So tying it back to the exam, it sounds like we have to find that balance of the cost of actually spinning up that redundant infrastructure and actually the cost of downtime, right? Am I following correctly?
Exactly. But one of the really cool things about the cloud is you only pay for that redundant infrastructure when you run it, right? So we can talk about having a game day where it's Saturday and we're going to simulate a failure with our infrastructure, and you're just paying for the time that you run that redundant infrastructure.
So let's keep cruising here. What else do we have to know for this section?
So we were talking storage and cost-optimized storage solutions. I think one thing that I'd like to point out is that when we look at Elastic Block Store, we want to make sure that we optimize IOPS, input-output operations per second, to manage cost, meaning don't over-provision your infrastructure.
But if you're running, also true about just about anything, right, Ted?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm jumping in here. It's not just about storage, right? Just right sizing your infrastructure is crucially important. So just understanding your workload requirements in general at the beginning is a key point, right? That allows you to right size and not over provision anything, storage or compute.
Yeah. And if we were to talk about compute solutions, you know, just set up your compute for what you need now. We don't want to over provision. I used to buy servers for 18 months from now, because I projected that, you know, the load on this server was going to be X. And I just had this CapEx budget that I could spend once every 18 or 24 months to get this hardware. Now we provision for what we need now, right? So we want to right size, and we want to make sure that we're not over provisioned, and use techniques like horizontal scaling and auto scaling to increase our compute as needed and match our actual capacity to our actual demand.
And this is also where a couple of useful services come in from the scaling side, right? We've mentioned before EC2 auto scaling, for example, and configuring that for being able to scale out your compute to handle larger loads. So this is also very effective from the cost management perspective, right? You don't want to be running a bunch of compute instances if you have lower load, but you will want to scale out to handle higher load and then scale back down. So this is something that kind of hits two points, both the cost management app viewpoint, but also the availability and scalability too, right? So it's kind of the same, it's kind of a different side of the same coin here.
Yeah, I think one thing that people don't realize is if you go into Cost Explorer, AWS will automatically identify what it sees based on ML and usage of your instances. What are some cost savings opportunities? What are your over-provisioned instances? Which ones aren't being used very much from a CPU point of view? Now, AWS doesn't see any of your data, but with Cost Explorer, we see some of the metrics that are available on your instances. You know, how much of that processing are you using? So you'll get recommendations on auto-scaling groups and instance types to help you lower your spend. Or sometimes to increase because you're not provisioned enough and you're under-provisioned.
I love that. Is there something you should be thinking about with cost that's not obvious, right? Like I'm in Cost Explorer, I'm looking at the services I enabled and I'm constantly thinking about how to optimize cost on those services. But are there things that just happen by having things in the cloud, you know, whether it's VPC or just the way things are set up and the way that it communicates that I should start thinking about for cost savings and maybe something that pops up on the exam too?
Yeah, I think that, you know, things you have to think about are data transfer out, and data transfer is a cost that varies depending on where you transfer data to, whether it's to the internet, to another region, or to another availability zone. So that cost is going to vary. And I think the most expensive cost is to the internet. And there's some things that you wouldn't think about. For example, I was talking to one customer who has a direct connect connection, which is dedicated fiber going from their data center into AWS. And they found that it was actually more cost effective from a data transfer cost point of view to use a dedicated connection than to transfer data over the internet, you know, where they were paying for the port hours on the direct connect connection.
Yeah.
But it was less expensive and it was a cost savings for a better connection where they had dedicated bandwidth. So yeah, there are things like that. There are things like AWS organizations. Most companies use multiple accounts. Well, you get cost savings if you put them all together in consolidated billing with an AWS organization.
The other advantage of doing something like that, right, Ted, is it gives you visibility into the costs across multiple accounts, right? We were talking about using things like cost allocation tags, for example, earlier in the episode, right, to segregate costs between different workloads and applications. But if you are running some things that you can't really tag, right? Like you can't tag traffic that is happening in your account. Segregating it based on account is a very effective way to do it. So you can understand what costs are associated to which account. So that way you completely isolate. And within the centralized billing in your organization, you can then get the complete view of what your costs are. It's a great point.
Yeah, I think that's a great suggestion, Anya, as far as, you know, limiting your cost per account and having separate accounts for each application, for development accounts, as well as when we go beyond costs with AWS organizations, you can put different restrictions on these other accounts. Maybe in your developer accounts, you don't get to build outside of this specific region. So there are other, you know, aspects that are pretty favorable for that as well.
One other point back to Dave's comment. You asked about, you know, something else to keep in mind that might catch people off guard when they're building in the cloud. One thing that I have personally come across and definitely have seen other customers run across as well is some costs that just tend to be per hour, right? Something that is running and you kind of forget about it. And one of those things is a networking service called the NAT Gateway. And that one has gotten some users quite a lot. So we haven't talked a lot about the NAT Gateway, but it's something that you're using to allow your instances in your private subnets to access the internet, right? And it's one of those things that is a component that you, you know, turn on and run and then can sometimes sort of forget about it if you terminate your instances, but the NAT gateway remains running, right? And it continues to accumulate costs. So that's something to think about because it is price per hour, but also per the amount of traffic that it transfers. So definitely always kind of keep track of that as you are working with your instances and terminate some of them if you no longer need them in your private subnets. The NAT gateway is something to always keep in mind.
Yeah, I flinched a little when you said that because NAT with network address translation is the killer of dreams when it comes to multiplayer games, like especially on Xbox. And in my household, I can't tell you how many hours I've spent in the router and in like everything just coming from Fios to get that all working for my kids. It all works now, but it's even like when you're on different services, you'll see it. And it was like, you know, they're like, Dad, I can't see my friends. I can't join the game. And I'm in the weeds looking at networking. So it just reminded me of that already. Nat and I don't get along. So having that as a service that builds hourly, I would always make sure I'm checking on it.
Definitely.
Very cool advice.
Yeah. My one add-on for that is if you're in a dev or a test environment, you don't need a NAT gateway. Set up a NAT instance.
Oh.
So Google that if you're curious on how to save a few bucks there.
I'm going to ask Amazon Q, Ted.
There you go. But use Q is better. But a NAT gateway is great. It's a highly available production-ready service.
Yeah.
To do network address translation at scale without any bandwidth limitations.
Awesome.
But if you want to play, you got to pay.
Do we want to do a sample question now with all of these different topics in mind?
I have a simple scaling question.
Let's do it.
Or a simple cost optimization question. So let's do this as we go through this here. So let's say your organization runs a fleet of on-demand EC2 instances in an auto-scaling group to help keep your compute utilization on par with current demand. How could you optimize your cost savings for compute?
Huh. Great question.
So you've got a fleet of EC2 instances, they're in an auto-scaling group. How do you do that cheaper?
First thing I would do is back to what we said, push off from your workload. Think about what your workload actually needs, right? And you would be able to optimize for like a steady state usage. So you would have something that is workload appropriate. So right-sizing your instance that would be able to take the load at a steady state. So don't get yourself a giant instance that costs a lot of money that you may not need, right? So you might start just analyzing your workload and picking an appropriate instance to begin with so you don't end up overpaying for that. That would be the first thing that I would consider.
Cool. How else can we save on our instance costs? Let's say we've decided that in our auto scaling group, we need M5X large instances. Is there a way we can get a better pricing than on demand?
Also a great question. That is definitely something that we had mentioned already in this episode. And that is something to look at any updated instances that we might have, right? As we mentioned, as compute evolves, we tend to be able to get newer and more efficient instance sizes. So if we have something that is more modern, it will likely cost less per hour. So that is something that you would be able to leverage by utilizing your auto-scaling group to leverage more updated instances. And then we have other types of approaches as well. We didn't directly discuss it in this episode, but EC2 has different kinds of approaches for you to save costs, right? We keep calling out on-demand as a type of EC2 instances. And that is a type of instance, which is exactly how it sounds like, on demand. You want it, you pay for it, and you get it. You don't want it, you turn it off, right? But there's other types of instances that we have. and that those are also an option. Ted, do you want to elaborate on the different types of instances that we offer aside from on-demand?
Sure. So we decide we want an instance type. We want a M5X large. So on-demand is like the most expensive way to pay for an instance. That is, you know, book price, MSRP, whatever you want to call it, is the most expensive way. But if I want to test something out, it's still really affordable. I want to run this job for an hour and I want to test this out. But then, you know, how about committing? You know, let's say I'm going to run an Active Directory server in my virtual private cloud. It's going to be running 24/7. Well, I can reserve that instance. And I can say that I want this instance type, this instance family in this region, and I can get a discount that may be 60 to 70% off.
That's a big savings.
Depending on my commitment, you know, whether it's a 1 or a 3 year commitment, but there's a significant savings. But what if I don't want to commit to a specific instance? Well, there are also what we have something called compute savings plans, where we say that we're committing to a specific amount of compute that we're going to use across multiple accounts. And this can be across multiple regions. So there are a variety of ways that we can add savings just for the compute that we're already using.
And one more thing to note here is that we actually have suggestions for that, right? Inside your Cost Explorer, there is a compute optimizer option, and it can actually give you a suggestion. Like, would you benefit from a reserved instance? Would you benefit from a savings plan? So you actually get to see some of that kind of given to you as a suggestion, which is great for people which may not be as experienced in choosing those things.
So yeah, Ted, I want to come back to the question. What would the right answer be? We talked a lot about different ways we could save. And I don't know if this specific question had a qualifier that we should look out to, or if many of these answers could potentially be correct based on a qualifier.
Yeah. So how could you most optimize your cost savings for compute? Well, you know, again, the actual exam is going to give us multiple choices. But I think if the answer had something like reserved instances or savings groups in there, or looking at newer generations, I think all three of those would be valid. And, you know, there's always just turning it off, too. That's a cost savings. and seriously, over the last year...
Ted, like, there's two things you said in there. I didn't mean to cut you off too.
Yeah.
If you want to finish your thought, but I just two real world things. One, I did a lot of R&D when I worked for a large pharma company. And a lot of these were on Linux clusters that we were using. And so I would suspend a lot of instances when I wasn't running. Like, a lot of these were blasts. So they were like genome sequences. I would suspend instances. And then I would also do the spot instances because it didn't matter like the timing of it all. It was just research. It wasn't production. And it was, everything was about, I had a budget for that research that was allocated. So that was the most important thing. So I was always the weird one that was like, yeah, I'm suspending stuff today and I'm going to go eBay some instances. And people are like, what? But it like worked out great from a research perspective, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you're stopping the taxi meter on the instances.
Right.
I've got a spot instance story as well. And we didn't really talk about these, but this is, you know, at AWS, we have all this unused inventory that's just sitting on the shelf. And the idea here is that you can use this unused inventory at up to 90% off the on-demand price. And that price is going to vary depending on availability and where and what type of compute it is. But if you have these jobs that are not time sensitive and can deal with interruptions or potential interruptions, this is a great cost saving. So during the pandemic, my daughter was really into Minecraft and she needed a Minecraft server. And I tried, this is before I started working at AWS, and I tried all these hosting services. But the problem that I had was she had 30 kids in her class that were all playing Minecraft at the same time. And the worlds would just crash. And I'd spend, you know, $30 a month and the server just wouldn't handle it. So I'm like, I can figure this out. I know how to use AWS. And I ended up doing a Docker container on Amazon ECS. our Elastic Container Service with a mapped EFS file store. So the whole world and all the files would persist if the instance ever went down. Okay, so I'm going down in the weeds here.
This is the most fun example of EFS that I've ever heard. Please continue. Yeah.
Okay, so the idea here was that I got like an M5 4X large instance to host Minecraft on, and it would handle these, you know, 30 kids that were all playing together. But instead of costing me hundreds of dollars a month, it was costing me $10 a month or something like that. And so I had a huge cost savings just from, and it was the only way I could afford to do my daughter's Minecraft work, just by using a spot instance. And if the kids got kicked off because an instance got reclaimed by AWS, because someone needed an on-demand instance, big deal. You know, and it would just...
That could handle interruptions.
Exactly. It was in an auto-scaling group. When there was an instance available, it would just scale back up and turn itself back on.
Well, what a note to leave it on. How fun. Ted, thank you for sharing. Anya and Ted, thank you so much for this wonderful episode. We learned so much in our part five. Everyone, look out for a part six. It'll be the last episode in our Get Schooled in Architecting series. Any previews for our guests that you might want to give them?
Well, we would like to use the last episode to kind of put a nice big bow on it and review a lot of the things that we covered in a whirlwind series here, Caroline. We have so much content, and this is sort of just skimming the surface of everything, but we want to tie it all together for our listeners to really get it in their mind of what kinds of questions they might see on the kind of content is there on the exam, and to really set them up for next steps to be able to continue their prep journey for this exam. Ted, you want to add anything?
No, I think that pretty much covered it. In the show notes, I'm going to give a link to how to set up your own Minecraft server, though, using ECS.
Yes, please.
And in our next episode, I'm really looking forward to giving more links to what are next steps as far as getting into solutions architect study.
Well, you heard it here first. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Caroline. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you.